Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
Well, free speech is once again on my radar, and of course it always is. The title of the show is Speak Free. But one of the things listeners will know that I follow a lot about what's happening in the academic space and with our universities, and very recently Auckland University's been exploring its freedom of expression and academic freedom policy, and there's been some updates and changes. And so I thought I'd turn to our good friends at the Free Speech Union to come on, and I'm joined today by Steph Martin, who is the Stakeholder Relationships Manager. And Steph, it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Oh, look, a pleasure. And this is a topic I find, well, firstly, vitally important and love to discuss. But look, listeners hear my voice all the time. They'd love to hear yours. Tell us what's happening at Auckland Uni.
So we've seen a pretty remarkable event happen in September. The Senate of the university has been presented with an academic freedom policy. So it's a policy for academic freedom and freedom of expression. And they have, after more than 4 years of work being put into this document to be presented to them, they have turned around and rejected it quite resoundingly. So we've seen an overwhelming majority of the Senate has turned around and looked at this document and said, no, we don't like it. And that is really quite a remarkable event, to have something that's a motion that's been put forward by the executive team, the university leadership, be rejected by its own staff. So we're talking about the Senate's made up of the professoriate as well as student and staff representatives. So it's really the university's own academic staff are saying that, essentially saying, this isn't sufficient to give us academic freedom and we want something better. And yeah, it's a remarkable event. And so what we'll be seeing this week is Wednesday was actually the day where council met to begin the conversation about next steps and what to do. So that's sort of why we want to draw some attention to it at the moment, is just to ensure that council actually takes the concerns seriously and that the voice of Senate isn't just sort of swept under the radar, because they do actually have the capacity to do that, as I understand. So we think really important that if the academics are turning around and trying to speak up on this, that their voices are heard, because obviously they are the core of the university.
Well, they are. And I think, look, we'll have to delve into actually what was wrong or perceived to be wrong, certainly by the academics in general, but also you guys there at the Free Speech Union. But it is quite remarkable, just to tease out what you've said, that the Senate, effectively the academics themselves, have rebelled, that's my word, but rebelled against the administrators. And it was the administrators, the executive, that had drafted this freedom of expression and academic freedom policy, which to me was anything but. But do you want to quickly explain to listeners what were some of the concerns within the policy that's been rejected?
Sure. So a couple of the ones that we see as being the most significant issues are around the inclusion of clauses, first of all, around well-being. So one of the clauses that we see as being really problematic reads, reasonable and proportionate regulation of conduct to enable the university to fulfil its duty regarding the well-being of staff and students. And a similar kind of line of restriction of freedom of expression being restricted on the grounds of health and safety. So well-being concerns and health and safety concerns, we've seen both of these things sort of used as sort of justifications for the suppression of speech by universities in recent years. And this has been, you spoke recently with Dr. James Kierstead, one of my wonderful colleagues at the New Zealand Initiative, about his report that really goes into this in comprehensive detail, what some of the deplatformings and things that have been actioned on the basis of health and safety. And so we know that these have been catch cries for the suppression of speech before. So to see them in a policy that's intended to guarantee academic freedom, or at least purported to be intended to guarantee that, is really problematic. So we know it's been used to counter free speech in the past. That's one of the key problems. Another key problem is that, I mean, if we're talking about well-being, how exactly are we going to define well-being in the sense of it's such a subjective and personal thing, what constitutes someone's well-being? And so if you're being expected as a member of staff or as a student of the university to be moderating your behaviour in relation to what might potentially negatively impact the well-being of people around you, then inevitably that's going to lead to self-censorship and the stifling of speech. I really can't see that going any other way. And
well, I'd suggest we've already got examples of it. I mean, look, words like well-being and health and safety, it says me to you, are at the vanguard of these efforts to suppress free speech, to actually yes. suppress ideas, which is the antithesis, of course, of universities or should be. But we've had already a number of people saying, yeah, your ideas, your thoughts, your words offend me. They hurt me. I mean, that's yes, the well-being situation. And that was the next thing I was just going to say. Oh, well, then please, please.
And harm, yeah. Because that's the other implication here, right, is around harm, right? So it's this idea that we've seen sort of pervade and ripple right through the sort of universities in recent years is this kind of notion of harm and claims that speech cause harm, which is, again, another catch cry that we've seen in these kind of efforts, right? And that being used as an excuse to censor. And I mean,
I find it quite hypocritical,
it's
actually.
It's antithetical to what the university should be, right?
Well, it's antithetical, but it's also, I would suggest, hypocritical, because if someone says, your words, Simon, are harming me, I have to silence you, I would say, well, then you're now harming me. I mean, yes. This is the problem with harm arguments, is they just go around like a very vicious, almost literal circle. But this was a university administration trying to legalize this in a way. And we've also seen, Steph, the health and safety side. I think your colleague, Jonathan Ayling from the Free Speech Union, they stopped him initially and others speaking at the university on health and safety. Well, based on health and safety reasons, the thugs veto, I think they call it.
So, yeah, there have been Free Speech Union deplatformings happen on the basis, on these sorts of bases before. And this was, I think, you're referring to the event at Victoria?
I am. That's the one that's particularly in my mind.
Yeah, so back in May, obviously, there was a symposium sort of discussion planned for how free speech could be sort of enacted at Victoria University. And there were particular concerns expressed by a small portion of students who said that the simply being a student who happened to walk through the quad when this event was taking place and happened to potentially hear the words of either Jonathan Ayling or another of my wonderful colleagues at the initiative, Michael Johnston. So it was the two of them were really the two that were supposedly harmful or potentially harmful to be hearing what they might have to say.
I mean, we have to ask at one level how we've got to this ridiculous situation. I mean, as you speak, I'm also hearing Jacinda Ardern's words at the UN that words are violence and drawing, you know, expressing ideas as equivalent to you know, warfare and violence. So, I mean, how on earth is it? How on earth have we got to a situation, Steph, that our universities are afraid of words and ideas and concepts?
Well, I think there's a lot to unpack there. I really think the safetyism culture is really critical to how this has happened, right? And Jonathan Haidt's done a lot of talking about this. It links back to what you were just talking about to do with harm, or we were talking about. It's sort of a mollycoddling that we've seen going on for some decades, right?
And it's a great, you mentioned Jonathan Haidt. He did that wonderful book with Greg, I think it's Lukianoff. I always say his name wrong, but The Coddling of the American Mind. It's exactly what you're saying. It's safetyism that you or the universities or the administrators believe they've got to keep specified groups, not all people, but specified groups safe from ideas. And they're prepared to deplatform, cancel, sack, fire anyone who might supposedly cause harm by expressing an idea. It's ludicrous.
It is, and it's completely, again, I come back to that word, antithetical for the university. I mean, one of the things that the university is supposed to be, right, is this sort of environment where we can have a contest of ideas to help us to solve problems and develop new knowledge and become more robust citizens. And that environment's just not being provided to students at the moment, it seems to me. I mean, I really benefited, I think, from a really wonderful university experience in that way. And I think it's a problem for everyone that we're not providing students in the next generation with this kind of environment.
Well, I know. I mean, I go back many, many more years, might I say, Steph, than your good self in university, but I enjoyed being challenged. I mean, that was for me part of the point, was not to go and be told that my views were right. It was nice when that might occasionally happen, but generally you were being challenged, and that's harmful in a way. We almost have to harm preconceived ideas of oneself in order to bring about change. That's healthy for a society, surely.
Well, and I think another thing that like really concerns me about this actually is that if we're not willing, and just linking back to what you, the words of Jacinda Ardern that you were citing just before, if we see words as violence and words become the frontier of violence, my concern there is that actually we'll end up in a place where we're actually at the stage of violence. Right, because when we're wanting to resolve differences between people and resolve conflicts that people have, because individuals are different, right? And we need to be able to live and work and solve problems together. And when we stop being able to do that through speech, then the next thing that's available to us is through action, right? And this is something, you know, I've got a background in primary school teaching, and I've observed this with children, and I think this is just actually true at a population level, that, you know, if a child doesn't know how to express a feeling that's a really overwhelming and intense feeling that they have, and they're unable to express that through words, then what inevitably happens is that they hit, they kick, they punch, they
lash out.
Expressive action, right? That's a lot more physical. And I think that to me is kind of like a microcosm of what would happen at a humanity level if we don't allow people to resolve issues through speech.
Oh, 100%. And look, very quickly on the Jacinda stuff, that mindset, that expression, which she doesn't share alone, but it's actually going to be a generative, it's going to generate violence.
Absolutely.
Hey, last point though, it's around the universities. I think you guys have referenced it as institutional neutrality. But one thing I seen, I think it was actually out of Victoria University, where someone was writing, might have been one of the pro vice chancellors or someone, but basically talking about the university is almost an entity, a corporation, my word there, that it has a view, whereas actually the traditional view of a university is that it's filled with academics, with a range of different disciplines, but a range of different perspectives, and therefore you're going to have variety, you're going to have disagreement. But we do appear to have, Steph, a move now to make universities into this, single corporate entity, which has its policies and its views and its statements, that sort of sits above, administrated by an executive, sits above the academics themselves, and then limits their freedom. Is this something you're seeing, concerned about, and is that why you're calling for this neutrality?
Yes, well, it's noteworthy that this policy makes no mention whatsoever of institutional neutrality, which, you know, it's sort of a glaring absence, if you will. So I think that's something that we should, a problem that we could draw with the document as well, that we don't see that there. This also, to me, reflects the sort of over time bureaucratization of the university, where we've seen universities shifting away from being this sort of open space for the contest of ideas, as you say, between academics, to the space where a primary concern, because we've got so many in management whose concern is not with academic rigor or the process of their disciplines, but with the brand of the university. And so a primary concern now is, how is this going to reflect on the university's brand? And that becomes paramount in thinking. And I think that's actually got a really key part to play in this.
And sadly, and this is just my observation, but the more controversial a topic becomes, the more risk there is if a university takes a position. So I am thinking of the likes of the treaty. So many universities now are making position statements. Their university, the corporate entity, if you will, says, well, this is our view. And you go, are there really meant to be any sacred cows at a university? Surely an academic is allowed to have a different opinion on that, or any issue, and hence why you're calling for that institutional neutrality. But yes. Is there any sign for hope? We obviously have this policy rejected at this stage of the process. I think that's hope-filled. Is there any other green shoots and signs of hope around New Zealand?
Well, as well as this, I mean, I do, as I've said to you before, I do see this as a really great signal that actually academics really recognise that this is a problem, and they're defending their own right to have academic freedom. Because a really ironic thing about this policy is that if it were to be brought into place, they would actually end up with less academic freedom than they currently experience, which is just absolutely bizarre to me that you could introduce an academic freedom policy that would restrict your academic freedom more than it was prior. But another thing that we could be looking at is the University of Otago statement as well. I think that's a really great sort of example. Here at Auckland, we're seeing academics actually standing up for their right to academic freedom, essentially. I mean, it is guaranteed in the Education and Training Act. So it is actually their right as academics for this to be upheld. Really, really great and encouraging to see that. We are also seeing the emergence of great policies like this one that's come out of Otago. Of course, we're yet to see how that gets implemented, and that's really critical, because you can make a great policy, but then if the implementation isn't there, then that can break down. But, you know, I think there's really great reason for hope looking at the Otago policy. I mean, if we have a look at the very first statement of that policy, I mean, the very first sentence there is, "Free speech is the lifeblood of a university."
Which that's, I thought, quite was encouraging, wonderful. Isn't it? It was. I must have put a huge smile on my face. I mean, I would say, you know, ultimately, free speech in universities is already under threat. It's already been undermined in different ways. We don't want it to go further. And so, where we started.
Exactly. And this shows that it can be done, right? The Otago policy shows that you can actually create an academic freedom statement that makes no mention of well-being, makes no mention of health and safety. It can be done. So, I mean, if we look if we look towards the university executive at Auckland, it's sort of, this isn't necessary. Why are you doing this? And also, it's so clearly out of step with what the staff themselves are actually wanting, right? And I think that's another one of these really big questions that we could be asking, right, is about the self-awareness of the university leadership. Like, how were they so very out of touch that they've created something that's so adrift from what their staff actually want?
Well, without taking us down a massive rabbit hole, mainly for the sake of time, is they're clearly morally certain of themselves that they're just right and probably everyone else is wrong, and they've got their view and they want to impose it. But it's great to see in this case that the faculty or the wider professorial membership of the Auckland University have stood up and said no. Hey, Steph, thank you for taking the time to talk us through this. We're going to have you back on. As you know, there's no shortage of topics to explore, but it was great having you on this morning.
Thank you. And this is part of a wider movement to get some academic freedom policies instantiated, right? So I'm sure there'll be plenty more to talk about as we see these policies grow and develop and shift and change all over the country. So, yeah, thank you so much. It's been a wonderful conversation. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on. And everyone, that was Steph Martin. She's the Stakeholder Relationships Manager at the Free Speech Union.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.